Good afternoon. The purpose of my talk is to talk about our experience in New York State with mandating influenza vaccination for healthcare workers, for certain healthcare workers, which we did last flu season, despite what Dr. Frieden said not to do. I think many of you know this, but I'll just go through it quickly. Unvaccinated healthcare personnel do present a risk to their patients by transmitting flu to them. Many healthcare personnel work while ill for a variety of reasons, obligation or lack of sick leave. Vulnerable patients, those who are most vulnerable to the side effects of influenza, congregate in healthcare facilities, and influenza can be transmitted 1 to 2 days before the onset of symptoms and up to 5 days after becoming sick. Healthcare personnel vaccination is shown to reduce disease and work time lost to influenza. Influenza infection is an occupational hazard. Since healthcare personnel do work with sick individuals, they are very likely to actually get influenza. In terms of our efforts to promote influenza vaccination of healthcare personnel, we made extensive efforts over the last decade. So much so that when these regulations were questioned by healthcare personnel and they said, well, you need to try education first, we just didn't understand that because we felt like that's what we've been doing. Some of the things we did, we sent annually a letter to healthcare providers and healthcare facilities informing them that influenza vaccination was the standard of care in New York State and promoting the ACIP guidelines. We also sent letters to insurers informing them that it was the standard of care and that they should cover all influenza vaccines. We did nursing home site visits that were conducted by both the immunization program in New York State and New York City. And we provided technical support to those nursing homes to review our nursing home law, which I'll get to in a little bit, to promote the immunization of healthcare personnel and the understanding and adoption of standing orders, and to provide sample materials. We worked with the medical societies of all sorts. We put materials on our public website. We did media campaigns using posters, buttons, public safety campaigns, and educational materials. These are our influenza toolkits, which we sent each year to every healthcare facility in the state, every hospital, every nursing home, and to local health departments, initially in paper form, then in CD, and lately we just post it. Example of a poster campaign and a button that we created for healthcare personnel to wear. We promoted immunization of healthcare personnel through our adult coalitions. We have more than 20 in our state, made up of representatives from state health departments, local health departments, home health agencies, hospitals, pharmacies, HMOs, community physicians, and nursing homes. And the mission is to improve adult immunization rates and to decrease vaccine-preventable diseases, and to support healthcare personnel influenza vaccination through local and regional meetings, mass mailings, and the promotion of our flu website. This is a summary of current healthcare personnel vaccination requirements in New York State. And you can see under hospitals and on the bottom other entities, diagnostic and treatment centers, hospices, home care agencies, and ESRD centers, dialysis centers, measles and rubella vaccination is required by regulation, and there is no exemption to that except for a medical exemption, no religious or philosophical exemption, and that's been in effect since, I believe, 98. For nursing homes, adult daycare programs, enriched housing programs, and any resident housing 5 or more persons over the age of 65, there is the same measles and rubella requirements apply. And then we also have Public Health Law 21A, which requires that influenza be offered to both employees and residents, but they can be refused. We call this the Long-Term Care Resident and Employee Immunization Act, and it was became effective in 2000 with the goal to protect the institutionalized elderly by promoting vaccination. And as I already said, the entities that it applied to. And it required the facilities to arrange and provide influenza vaccination to all their staff and residents every year and to document the status of residents and employees. But as I said, employees can refuse for any reason. And we do a yearly survey of all these facilities. And so despite this law and despite all our outreach efforts, in these long-term care facilities, we have never gotten a cumulative rate of immunization much over 44%. But that is not in hospitals, that is in long-term care facilities, that's a caveat. And this shows, that is of staff, this graph shows the resident rates over the years, and that has remained fairly high in the 80% and fairly steady in between the different types of facilities. But then again, looking at staff, though we have made a little progress, as you can see over the years in adult day and healthcare facilities, we have not really gotten anywhere near 60% overall. So New York State made the decision to move towards mandatory healthcare personnel influenza vaccination. And this was made around 2008, and we spent several years laying the foundation for this change. We didn't just decide to do it overnight. We had the Article 21A, and we proposed amendments to that legislation during the 2008 state legislative session, making it mandatory for long-term care facilities. That has not gone anywhere yet. We met with several of the nurses' organizations, the unions, in a fall 2008 roundtable. We did repeated presentations on the subject, and we also presented at public meetings of the State Hospital Review and Planning Council, known as SHRPIC, and that is the body that is responsible for approving the regulations in hospitals. In terms of a timeline for these regs, SHRPIC adopted an emergency regulation on August 13th, 2009. It was effective immediately at that time. It covered both seasonal and H1N1 influenza vaccines, but unfortunately the regulation was suspended on October 23rd due to insufficient supply of both vaccines. And the emergency regulation was then allowed to expire in November, and it was not renewed. I thought I would just go over a little bit what was in that regulations. I figured you would be curious. These are some of the definitions, and we struggled with these, and this was what was in those emergency regs. Medically contraindication states that the vaccination would be detrimental to the person's health in a manner recognized nationally, and that guidance would be posted on our website describing what is appropriate medical exemptions. So again, consistent with our other regulations, we did not allow a religious or philosophical exemption. We went with a broad definition of personnel, and that this is a hard nut to crack. We said it was all persons employed or affiliated, paid or unpaid, including members of the medical staff, contract staff, students, and volunteers. And this is, quote from the regs, who either have direct contact with patients or whose activities are such that if they were infected with influenza, they could potentially expose patients or others who have direct contact with patients. And while that is a very broad definition, it was a very hard definition to implement. These are the healthcare facilities that were covered by the regs, the general hospitals, diagnostic and treatment centers, certified home health agencies, licensed home care service agencies, long-term home health care programs, AIDS home care programs, and hospices. The requirements stated that healthcare facilities needed to notify their staff about this requirement and require that they all be immunized against influenza, that the immunization should be conducted according to national recommendations in effect and posted on the state website, and that immunization will take place unless the Commissioner of Health has determined that supply is not adequate. So that was in the regs, and that is what was acted upon. In terms of the cost of vaccination, the facilities must offer this to the personnel, and it must be free of charge to them. They can go elsewhere to get their vaccination, but they will have to go through their own insurance and pay for it if they need to. In terms of existing personnel, we said that vaccination must be completed by November 30th of each year. For new personnel, if the person enters employment after November 30th but before April 1st, their status had to be evaluated, and if they had not received and could not document their influenza vaccinations, they had to be vaccinated at that time. And then in terms of documentation, the healthcare facilities had to maintain the records and personnel files, and we listed what needed to be documented, which is the standard kind of immunization things, the date, the site of administration, type of vaccine, dose, manufacturer, lot number, et cetera. And if they were vaccinated elsewhere, they had to bring the documentation to the facility. As I said, exceptions were for medical contraindications only. And we had, again, this statement about how it should be done in accordance with national recommendations. We couldn't actually incorporate a standard into the regs. This was something our lawyers would not allow us to do. And again, this is consistent with previous regulations. There was a reporting requirement in the regulations, and said that all healthcare facilities had to collect and report aggregate numbers on influenza and immunization of personnel to the New York State Department of Health by May 1st of each year. And even though the regulations were suspended, we did survey the facilities, and I'll get to that in a minute. And that the data was to include but not be limited to the number of personnel by occupation, the total number of personnel, and the reasons any personnel did not receive vaccine. So what was the response? As you can imagine, there was major strong opposition from nurses primarily. The New York State Nurses Association was opposed and said so repeatedly. The Bureau itself got thousands of letters, thousands of phone calls. There were several small protests and organized letter writing campaigns. We would get the same letter that said exactly the same thing with a different signature over and over and over. The anti-vaccine movement came involved. And there were two lawsuits that were then, that were dropped when the regulations were suspended. And some of you may have seen this article in the New England Journal, but this is the legal view of regulatory approaches, and she said that although they have the same rights as all private citizens, it is likely that courts will continue to make the health and safety of patients the priority in permitting exceptions to individual rights. We don't know if that would have been applied to our lawsuits or not. This is in 1990, our regulations with measles and rubella were challenged, and the court did find that the state had acted according to their legislative mandate to protect their patients and the inhabitants of the state, and they were upheld. And I do really like this quote from the court: "Hospitals do not exist for the benefit of their employees, they exist for the benefit of their patients. They exist to cure the sick. The legislature of this state has charged the Commissioner of Health with the responsibility of making hospitals safe places to get well. These regulations are tailored to accomplish that end." And if we could get a ruling like that, that would be great. In terms of our experience, we had to adapt quickly. The questions about interpreting the regs required us to have an ongoing question and answers that were drafted and were changed almost daily, it seemed. We responded to those huge volume of calls and letters. Callers were extremely angry, and we actually had to set up a call center to accept the thousands of phone calls because we were so overwhelmed. Some of the sticking points, you can imagine that definition of personnel was difficult to interpret and operationalize, and we're learning about that with the version that's going forward. Lack of religious exemption was contentious, and adhering to a standard of medical exemption was contentious. People wanted to be able to come up with their theories about why they shouldn't get it. What should be done with those who refused and had medical exemptions was an ongoing discussion. Should they be able to wear masks? Should they not work at all? Should we accept that small risk and let them work? And it wasn't entirely resolved. So here are the survey results, and we were very excited about this until we saw the national results. But in the seasonal 08-09, 46% of our hospitals, that's the only facilities we surveyed, reported that they had vaccinated their, all our hospitals had reported that they had vaccinated 46% of their staff. But in 09-10, it was reported that they immunized 71% for seasonal flu, and then for H1N1, it was only 33%. And this slide looks at medical exemptions, and you can see that for seasonal flu, the medical exemption rate was 1.23%, which is not too bad, considering that we know that about 1% of people are medical, can get medical exemptions. And for H1N1, it was 0.77%. And I think that's really just because, due to supply, they never pressed their staff to the wall to say, you have to get this. That just never got that point. And you can see the range for both 0 to 9%. So there were some facilities that had a 9% medical exemption rate, and we're looking into what that means. In terms of the future, the regulations are being revised and clarified based on what we learned, and the plans are to go forward with permanent adoption, and the plans are to address long-term care facilities through statute. And that's my presentation. Thank you very much. Thanks to my staff.